Thousands of protesters filled the streets of Manhattan's financial district last night. They came to show support for Occupy Wall Street, a demonstration that's now in its third week. Some of the marchers represented labor unions and other organizations, but as NPR's Joel Rose reports, many were just ordinary New Yorkers who came to voice their support for the populist protest.
What started out as a few dozen activists in New York's Zuccotti Park swelled into a sea of protesters on Wednesday.
Banks got bailed out.
We got sold out.
Banks got bailed out.
We got sold out.
Banks
Thousands of demonstrators marched through Lower Manhattan at rush hour, chanting slogans like, Banks got bailed out, we got sold out, and we are the 99%. Many of the marchers wore jackets and T-shirts emblazoned with union logos. Tom Linane from the Transit Workers Union says the Occupy Wall Street protesters have a lot in common with organized labor.
We're paying for the mistakes that the rich made. That's what we're doing at this point in time, and we continue to pay their dues. They bailed out the banks, they bailed out Wall Street, and we're paying for the bailout.
But while unions have been trying to get that message out for years without a great deal of success, it took Occupy Wall Street just over 2 weeks to capture the attention and imagination of thousands of protesters in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and other cities. Nelson Rios had never attended a protest before this week.
Like, everyone I know, every single person is just getting, like, poorer and poorer every day. And, like, I have a job. I'm not a hippie, you know, I'm not unemployed. And I see their stock going up, and it's like my pay just keeps going down.
It's touched me, this entire enterprise, and I think I've kind of been waiting for something like this.
Ann Baxter says she's glad that Occupy Wall Street is calling attention to the role of corporate money in politics.
The frustration with money in politics is being spoken about, and it's an enormous problem.
Baxter thinks the country needs tougher campaign finance laws. Other protesters held up signs advocating more regulation of Wall Street, higher taxes on the rich, universal health care, and a lengthy list of other progressive environmental and social causes. Critics have dismissed the organizers of Occupy Wall Street as naive and unfocused. But at least one analyst thinks they're missing the point.
I think it has the potential to be a social movement, one that we haven't seen in at least a couple of decades in this country. It's clearly a broad populist movement right now.
Dorian Warren, teaches political science at Columbia University, went downtown to watch the protest. He says the big turnout reflects a significant level of support for Occupy Wall Street.
I think why it's resonated so quickly is because unions and other groups have been raising these issues for decades. It's what they've been doing and what they've been trying to do, but it just took a spark from an organic set of organizers and protesters to make it happen.
Occupy Wall Street first caught the attention of the wider public when more than 700 protesters were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge last weekend. Protesters filed a lawsuit yesterday claiming that police lured them onto the bridge in order to arrest them. Compared to that, this march was relatively peaceful, with only a few dozen arrests reported.
We're here today on behalf of working people.
Those who have a job.
Those who have a job.
The march ended in Zuccotti Park, where George Gresham, president of the local health care workers union, led the demonstrators in a chant. Later, Gresham was quick to point out that Occupy Wall Street was in charge, not the unions.
But we want to take leadership from them. I think they've done a good job. We hope that this thing catches on in the country and that those who are in power can understand that working people's voice will be heard in this country again.
For at least one night, you could hear those voices loud and clear in Lower Manhattan. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Now, Steve Jobs did not invent the computer or the mouse or the smartphone or MP3 players, but his vision made them accessible, user-friendly, and enormously popular. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, one of Steve Jobs' greatest legacies is his impact on design.
It's true, Steve Jobs didn't invent computers, though he was obsessed with them from an early age. In 1975, at the age of 20, Jobs was part of the Homebrew Computer Club, a group of early computer enthusiasts obsessed with creating more accessible computers.
People all together in a room, jostling, bubbling with ideas, bringing in new technology, new chips, new displays, new networks, new software, everything new.
At least it was new back then, says John Gage, who was a member of the Homebrew Computer Club. Gage says from the get-go, Jobs' talent was to take all those different pieces of technology and incorporate them into one design.
With the result, an elegant, simple, human-usable device. That was Steve's genius. He saw clearly how to take this enormous complexity and make something a human being could use.
The first Apple II computer, which came out in 1977, was designed to be more like a home appliance. Up until then, you had to know how to put them together yourself. But it was the design of the Macintosh that set the public on fire. In 1984, Steve Jobs introduced the Mac in front of an audience of thousands.
Hello, I'm Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag.
The computer voice went on to poke fun at IBM computers. Never trust a computer you can't lift, it said. It had a mouse and the graphical user interface, not the first computer to have them, but it was the first time a computer with those features was commercially successful. The Mac made the computer a creative device for the average person. Again, John Gage.
He brought music and art. He brought visual sensation. He brought capabilities to the computer that were not dreamed of by those that were at the lower levels of putting together the chips that would do the fast computation or store all the bits of a picture.
In 1985, Steve Jobs was pushed out of Apple in a boardroom coup. The company floundered. He returned in 1997. He stripped down the company the way he stripped down design, cutting out product lines. Robert Brenner was at Apple during the time Jobs was gone. When he returned, Brenner says he unleashed the power of the company's designers.
There obviously is a culture and an environment there as a designer, if you're good, that will allow you to support you in doing great things.
The iMac, released in 1998, looked unlike any other personal computer. Up until then, computers were little ugly plastic boxes. The iMac was cute and curvy. In 2001, the iPod reshaped the idea of an MP3 player. It had a simple user interface with a wheel in the front that you could turn to scroll through all your songs in a little window. Then, in 2007, Apple entered the smartphone market. Jobs poked fun at the other smartphones, and then he introduced the iPhone.
What we want to do is make a leapfrog product that is way smarter than any mobile device has ever been and super easy to use. This is what iPhone is. Okay?
Brenner says Jobs was obsessed with the best materials. Not plated plastic, but real machined metal. Not black plastic, but glass. Brenner says Apple would build a new factory if that's what it took to make the product right.
Very few companies would do that. Say that here's an object we believe needs to be made this way. Let's go out and create an entire infrastructure to do it.
Brenner says Steve Jobs raised the profile of design. Brenner, who now has his own firm, says there is a dark side to that. Everybody wants their products to look just like Apple's.
If it's not a machine piece of aluminum with black glass and one button, it's not good.
Still, Brenner says the world of computers is a better place because of Steve Jobs. The design was friendly, and that made computers more than machines. It made them objects that customers could love. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
To Capitol Hill now, where Senate Democrats are making a change to President Obama's jobs bill. They want to pay for it by putting a 5% tax on earnings over $1 million. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
President Obama had proposed paying for his jobs bill by raising an assortment of taxes, targeting oil companies, corporate jet owners, and families earning more than $250,000 a year. But even members of his own party had expressed concerns about those tax changes. So Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has swapped in a millionaire surtax, something he says has populist support.
Independents, Democrats and Republicans, and even the Tea Party agree it's time for millionaires and billionaires to pay their fair share of taxes.
Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said on the Senate floor the changes are purely political.
Our Democratic friends want to jettison entire parts of the bill altogether, not to make it more effective at growing jobs, not to grow bipartisan support. No, they want to overhaul the bill to sharpen its political edge.
He and other Republicans argue with a weak economy, this is not a time to raise taxes. Reid says he'll bring up the bill on the floor next week, where it faces long odds. And on the House side, Majority Leader Eric Cantor says the jobs bill is dead. Tamara Keith, NPR News, the Capitol.
The winner of this year's Nobel Prize in Literature was announced this morning. It is Swedish poet Tomas Tranströmer. Joining us now is NPR's Neda Ulubi. Good to have you, Neda.
Hi, Lynn.
And a Nobel bridesmaid finally won the prize.
Yes. Trans Stromer has long been mentioned as a candidate for the Nobel, and when the announcement was made this morning, you heard something highly unusual. Swedish people screaming with joy.
Really? He's very popular there.
He's wildly popular.
So tell us a little bit more about him.
Well, he was born in Stockholm in 1931 to a fairly well-off and literary family. He's been a star in Sweden since he was 23 years old when he published his first volume of poetry. But he's also had a very long and distinguished career as a psychologist and a social worker. He works with troubled kids and convicts, or he did, rather, before he had a debilitating stroke in 1990. And he's a pianist as well. He used to perform occasionally during his readings, but since his stroke, he still plays the piano, but only with one hand.
It's very multi-talented. Did his training as a psychologist figure into his writing in any way?
Yeah. He's interested in moments of self-assessment and the space between conscious thought and the subconscious. He was drawn to surrealist writers from an early age, and his own work treads the line between wakefulness and dreams. He's a spellbinding and quite haunting poet. I'm going to read you this really short poem he wrote about getting into a car crash. Okay? The approaching traffic had huge lights. They shone on me while I pulled at the wheel in a transparent terror that floated like egg white. The seconds grew. There was space in them. They grew as big as hospital buildings.
Wow, that's quite a poem, that idea of floating in egg white. So he is the seventh European to win the Nobel Literature Prize in the last 10 years. Has this Eurocentric focus drawn any criticism at all?
Oh, yes. Now, Trans Stromer, I think, deserved the prize. He's an extraordinary poet with a huge following here. He's good friends with Robert Bly, and he's very influential both in the United States and around the world. But it's hard not to think about the words of the permanent secretary of the Swedish Academy a few years ago when he criticized American writers for being too isolated and insular. After seven European writers being awarded the Nobel for Literature in 10 years, you have to wonder if those words might not be applied to the Swedish Academy itself.
Huh. Well, thanks for joining us this morning, Neda.
Thank you, Lynn.
NPR's Neda Ulubi talking with us about this year's winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature. He is Swedish poet Tomas Trans Stromer.
The Nobel Prize in Literature, of course, did not go to an American. 1993 would be the last time when it went to Toni Morrison. And critic Alexander Nazarian says it's our own fault. Our literature doesn't deserve it. And he said just that in a recent article in Salon. Alexander Nazarian, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can I be forgiven for never hearing of Tomas Trans Stromer?
Absolutely. You'll be with the vast majority of American readers and probably readers outside of Sweden.
Probably readers outside the world, right, around the world, right?
Yeah, I think they all went to Wikipedia this morning and tried to learn how to spell his name. And that's not said to criticize his poetry. It's pretty clear, though, that nobody had any clue.
Let's talk American writers for a moment, because I think it was about 3 years ago that the head of the Nobel Literature Committee essentially said America isn't producing any good work and that the best writers are European. So have they gamed the system against us?
I don't think it's quite a conspiracy, but a lot of people were outraged when he said that. David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, being one of the more prominent critics, Adam Kirsch wrote in Slate what I think was a very reasonable and angry piece criticizing the permanent secretary for saying that. But the truth is, his words, I think, struck a chord, and one that wasn't false, about what's happened to our literature in, I would say, the last three decades.
What is wrong, in your view, with American writers right now?
We've become a nation of literary narcissists. Part of that comes out of the write what you know tradition, which I think must be taught in every single MFA program. And then don't try to assume characters who are unlike yourself. So, for example, you know, if you are a white male, write from the perspective of a white male. Don't write like William Styron did from the perspective of a slave, for which he got pilloried for in The Confessions of Nat Turner. I'm not saying that's a great book, but I think David Foster Wallace in 1997, in an essay for the New York Observer, pretty brutal takedown of an Updike novel, comes up with this term, the great male narcissist, which is a writer who's purely inward-looking and just unwilling to engage with the world. And I think today, every writer, regardless of gender or ethnicity, the majority of writers are great male narcissists. And I talk about Jhumpa Lahiri, Jonathan Safran Foer, Jonathan Franzen. I don't see big political, social engagement in their works. I see narrow concerns, not a lot of cultural criticism of the sort that, for example, John Steinbeck does in Grapes of Wrath, or even, you know, John Le Carré does in some of his finer spy fiction, which, to tell you the truth, is much more intelligent than what comes out of many American writers today.
I mean, you say writers are encouraged to write from their perspective and to write what they know, but how should they sort of be thinking about writing differently? I mean, what would they write?
Well, first of all, I think you have to have experience. Hemingway, of course, wrote from the viewpoint of many times his own self. But he'd done a lot of things. He'd been to war. He'd lived in Paris. If he'd just gone to college and then to a writing seminar and then moved to Brooklyn, I don't think he could have written The Sun Also Rises.
And that's you're essentially saying that is who is writing novels in America today.
That's the vast majority. Not everybody. There are really wonderful writers who are outside that. And there are writers within that sort of mainstream culture who are doing interesting things. But I think the vast majority of writers are almost afraid of imagination. And that, to me, is frightening because many of our great works are founded on this immense leap of faith. Imagine if Cervantes said, well, this is crazy. A guy goes around chasing windmills and wearing a pot on his head. Nobody's going to buy this. This, you know, I'll just write about my childhood or something.
That's Alexander Nazarian. He's on the New York Daily News editorial board. He writes on literature and culture for a variety of publications. His essay on the Nobel Prize for Literature was published at Salon.com. Alexander, thanks.
Thank you very much.